The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. The Chauvin trial is over, but it exposed a great divide in our nation.
We are not a systemically racist country. We're the greatest country in history.
We'll look at the irresponsible rhetoric that's being used as an argument for a mistrial.
Well, we got to stay on the street, and we've got to get more active. We've got to get more confrontational. We've got to make sure that they know that we mean business.
Progressives continue to disrespect our men and women in blue.
They've gone from defunding the police to abolishing the police, and now even no more policing. So this is just getting crazier and crazier by the day.
And later, the world grows increasingly dangerous.
The Chinese Communist Party officials are just laughing behind their backs.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. And follow this program as well, at Town Hall Review. The trial of Derek Chauvin ended in a conviction on all three counts in what is now officially the murder of George Floyd. The 45-year-old Chauvin was convicted of second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and manslaughter. For much of America, there was a sense of relief, or at least closure. Most who watched the videotape events of that day were left with an overwhelming feeling that what happened to George Floyd was deeply unjust. But President Biden reacted by going directly into the area where Americans are most deeply divided. He called the United States systemically racist. Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan discussed the president's comments with my colleague and fellow Buckeye, Bob France, from AM 1420, The Answer, in Cleveland.
Congressman, he declared that this verdict essentially ripped the blinders off and proved that the United States is a systemically racist nation. He then went on to praise last summer's protest, but he praised it and said that the summer of 2020 was the summer of protest that united people. Congressman, there were billions of dollars in damages done in protests across this country last year.
Yeah.
Hundreds of police officers seriously injured, some of them killed, countless businesses shut down, countless people put out of work by smash and loot. And he called this a unifying moment and declared that this is proof that we're a systemically a racist nation. How do you respond to that from the commander-in-chief of this country?
We are not a systemically racist country. We're the greatest country in history. The vast, vast, vast majority of police officers do an amazing job under extraordinary circumstances trying to protect our communities and protect us. There are a couple people who do, a handful of people who do bad things, and they should be held accountable. And we trust the American justice system, and that played out yesterday. That's the takeaway here in my mind, not ridiculous statements from Maxine Waters last weekend think about that, Bob. She was actually admonished by the trial judge in the courtroom for what she said in that town, made a special trip up to Minneapolis in the days before there's going to be some kind of verdict from the jury, and says the ridiculous and crazy things that she says, and actually gets admonished by the trial judge. So, no, we need to come back to the basic facts, which are we're the greatest country ever, and the vast majority of police officers do an amazing job, and those that don't are held accountable, and that's what played out yesterday.
Yeah, it did to a degree. And here's my problem, though. My problem is not necessarily, I don't feel any sympathy for Derek Chauvin, because I think he was cavalier. He was brazen, and I think he was foolish and maybe neglectful. But I don't think that the evidence proved that he caused this man's death. But that notwithstanding, the question, Congressman, is have we now proven that in this country we can have trial by riot? Because there are a lot of people who believe that these jurors jurors were terrified of coming back with anything other than guilty for fear of not only themselves being put into danger. You know, there was a witness who testified for the defense who had pig's blood smeared all over their what was thought to be their home, being doxxed, being targeted because of riotous behavior. Some people feel like, well, now that's the key. You want to get a cop convicted?
Yeah.
If you want to get an outcome that you demand, just threaten to riot and burn stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we'll have to see. Look, there's an appeal process. As I said, the trial judge talked about some of this stuff. We'll have to see, were some of these jurors actually influenced in that in a way? Well, did they see what Maxine Waters said? Were they a part of that? So I think you have to let our justice system, our criminal justice system, the court system, you have to let that play out.
Prior to the Chauvin conviction, the streets of Minneapolis were filled with anxious citizens, many of them concerned that justice would not be served. Among the crowd, Congresswoman Maxine Waters from California. She traveled to the state to make a statement, which we played in the open of the program, that many believe was a threat of violence if Chauvin was not convicted. Here's Salem host Larry Elder.
Do you know that Maxine Waters almost got this Derek Chauvin trial declared a mistrial? Here's what Maxine Waters said over the weekend.
Reform. And so, yes, I would like to see the bill in Congress pass on police reform, but I know that the right wing, the racists, are opposed to it, and I don't know what's going to happen to it, but I know this, we've got to stay in the street, and we've got to demand justice.
As a black man, despite all of the efforts, I feel like nothing changes, and George Floyd is waking so many people up. Yet nothing has happened, despite the rhetoric. But what needs to happen that's different this year than all the years before?
We're looking for a guilty verdict.
We're looking for a guilty verdict, and if you don't get it?
We're looking for a guilty verdict, and we're looking to see if all of the talk that took place and has been taking place after they saw what happened to George Floyd, if nothing does not happen, then we know that we've got to not only stay in the street, but we've got to fight for justice.
We have to stay in the street, she said, and fight for justice.
I am very hopeful, and I hope that we're going to get a verdict that would say guilty, guilty, guilty.
Guilty, guilty, guilty. Meaning guilty on all three charges.
We cannot go away.
And not just manslaughter, right? I mean.
Oh, no, not manslaughter. No, no, no. This is guilty for murder. I don't know whether it's in the first degree, but as far as I'm concerned, it's first degree.
Did you hear that? I don't know whether it's in the first degree, but as far as I'm concerned, it's first degree. He has not been charged with first degree murder. So already you're saying this is unjust, Maxine Waters.
Guilty, guilty. And if we don't, we cannot go away.
And not just manslaughter, right? I mean.
Oh, no, not manslaughter. No, no, no. This is guilty for murder.
Manslaughter is murder, but.
I don't know whether it's in the first degree, but as far as I'm concerned, it's first degree.
Congressman, what happens if we do not get what you just told? What should the people do? What should protesters on the street do?
I didn't hear you.
What happens?
What should protesters do?
Well, we got to stay on the street, and we've got to get more active. We've got to get more confrontational. We've got to make sure that they know that we mean business.
We have to stay on the streets. Now, this is what this congressperson almost did. She almost caused a mistrial. The defense has argued from the very beginning that the jury should be sequestered, as it was during the O.J. Simpson case. And the jury is always given an instruction to not watch the news. And the defense argued it's awfully difficult not to watch the news when it's infused. And when somebody like Maxine Waters makes the allegation that she just now made, the defense argued that it's awfully difficult to realistically expect the jury not to have heard this. And they made a motion for a mistrial.
During the course of this trial, I've received literally thousands and thousands and thousands.
This is the defense.
Of
Eric Nelson.
Emails. So much so that I don't even look at that particular email anymore. And it is so pervasive that I just don't know how this jury, it can really be said to be that they are free from the taint of this. And now that we have U.S. representatives threatening acts of violence in relation to this specific case, it's mind-boggling to me, Judge.
Well, I'll give you that Congresswoman Waters may have given you something on appeal.
I will give you, Congresswoman Waters may have given you something on appeal, meaning in the event that Derek Chauvin is convicted, one of the grounds for reversal will be public notoriety and sentiment stirred up by the likes of Maxine Waters.
It's mind-boggling to me, Judge.
Well, I'll give you that Congresswoman Waters may have given you something on appeal that may result in this whole trial being overturned. But what's the state's position?
Wow.
Position.
Your Honor, the state's position, first and foremost, is that we can't allow statements like this, vague statements, to be considered a part of the record on appeal. If there's a specific statement that a specific U.S. representative made, then there needs to be some sort of formal offer of proof with the exact quotes of the exact statement or some kind of a declaration. And I'm sure Mr. Nelson can do that if he thinks that that's something that's appropriate. I don't know that this particular representative made a specified threat of violence. I don't know what the context of the statement is. I also don't know what television shows Mr. Nelson is referring to in terms of any of this. And so I just don't think that we can muddy the record with vague allegations as to things that have happened without, you know, very specific evidence that's being offered before the court. As a practical matter, through the jury selection process, the court has provided instructions, has determined whether or not there are any outside influences. The law presumes that the jury follows the judge's instructions, and the court has instructed the jury that they're not to let any outside influences or public opinion sway their deliberation. And Your Honor, I make my comments in the context of this is all such an evolving situation, and I certainly can supplement the record with news articles. I can supplement the record with, you know, the storylines of the particular shows that were brought to my attention. So I'm making it to note the record at this particular point, and I can certainly supplement.
Yeah, you can supplement the record with whatever media reports. I'm aware of the media reports. I'm aware that Congresswoman Waters was talking specifically about this trial and about the unacceptability of anything less than a murder conviction, and talk about being confrontational. This goes back to what I've been saying from the beginning. I wish elected officials would stop talking about this case, especially in a manner that is disrespectful to the rule of law and to the judicial branch and our function. I think if they want to give their opinions, they should do so in a respectful and in a manner that is consistent with their oath to the Constitution, to respect a co-equal branch of government. Their failure to do so, I think, is abhorrent, but I don't think it has prejudiced us with additional material that would prejudice this jury. They have been told not to watch the news. I trust they are following those instructions and that there is not in any way a prejudice to the defendant beyond the articles that we're talking specifically about the facts of this case. A congresswoman's opinion really doesn't matter a whole lot.
Coming up, John Kerry goes to China, but not to discuss the atrocities coming from that country.
The Chinese Communist Party officials are just laughing behind their backs.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. As many blue cities have cut police budgets, the results have proven disastrous. Where there are fewer police, violent crime has increased. And that increase is disproportionately taking place in black neighborhoods. While a great majority of those citizens are against defunding police, the call from the far left remains the same. Paul Kengor, professor of political science at Grove City College, discussed the topic while on with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer, out of Chicago.
The disconnect between residents, even residents that have concerns about police and police brutality and how black Americans are treated by police improve on the margins, but they recognize the important role police play, something that the dyed-in-the-wool Democrat socialists don't seem to recognize.
Well, that's right. And, you know, Sheriff Dave Clark, who was the sheriff of Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, which I guess isn't terribly far from you guys, right?
No.
And, yeah, and he said, a favorite quote of mine from his, that he said last year was, in regard to this idea of defunding the police, he said, quote, you'd have to loathe black people to do that, right? The police are the only thing standing between them and violent crime predators. And of course, that's exactly right. It's common sense. And yet you've got people like Rashida Tlaib out there this week, which, by the way, both she and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said was no accident, right? And this was the case of the female police officer in Brooklyn City, Wisconsin, Brooklyn Center, Wisconsin. So no more policing and no more incarceration. So they've gone from defunding the police to abolishing the police, and now even no more policing. So this is just getting crazier and crazier by the day with these people.
Well, and how has the Dante Wright death ratcheted up the rhetoric to a new level?
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, that's where they are, Amy. I mean, rather than pausing and calmly looking at this situation and say, okay, you know, this is awful. This is another tragedy. But clearly, we've got the police office here. Police officer here. Her name was Kim. I'm trying to think of the last
Potter.
Name. Yeah, that's it. They, you know, clearly she's on tape. She's on video, saying, you know, I'm going to taser you, right? And then she reaches and she pulls out what she thinks is her taser, and following the instruction manual, she was on the police force for almost 30 years. She trains people, right? So she yells, taser, 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 which is like a situation when you're in a hospital and somebody's having a heart attack and you're about to hit them with trying to jump start them back to life, right? So she yells, taser, 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 which means clear, clear, clear. And instead she has her gun and she pulled the trigger on her gun. By the way, if you watch the video on this, all this happens in like 5 seconds. I mean, not even 10 seconds. I mean, this happens in like 5 seconds. It's a completely chaotic situation. And
yeah,
she shot the guy. Yeah,
But here's the thing. There's no point in addressing these things on the merits with respect to the Marxist ideologues. And I think that the left should continue beating the drum of defunding the police, because the political gain is to enlist young people who make sure that they're part of the Democrat socialist governing coalition.
For exactly that. I mean, they were calling for that a year ago. So yeah, this is socialists, which are all about big government, right, and massive government, here all of a sudden. But I was reading a piece in, I think it was the Fox News website yesterday, by Newt Gingrich, and he shared some shocking facts. I mean, is this true? He said that there were 264 police officers that were killed in 2020, 264, which was a 96% increase over the previous year.
When Joe Biden called climate change an existential threat to humanity and a top priority, he apparently meant it. Even the Chinese internment camps appear to have failed to make his radar as he sends John Kerry overseas to talk about the climate in China and discuss this misplaced priority with John Elliott, former deputy assistant to President Trump. Explain to people where John Kerry ended up in the middle as China engages in genocide, where John Kerry went.
So this is the first senior administration official to actually touch down in China. And, you know, we're engaged in a great power competition, and we are in the middle of the coronavirus that they unleashed on the world with close to 3 million deaths worldwide and 560,000 plus deaths tragically here in the U.S. So Kerry touches down to discuss, just wait for it, climate change. Can you imagine that? I mean, unbelievable. You have this no matter what your views are on the science behind climate change, and there was a great piece in the Wall Street Journal by Holman Jenkins, who outlines the last 2 decades of questioning that but questioning the whole idea of the climate crisis, if you will, or climate change crisis, even if that were a true priority and it would have to rank something like 90th on our list, why would the Biden administration send its first official to touch down there with everything that's going on with China, coronavirus, South China Sea? Suga and Biden were just meeting with that, and they had Suga had a strong statement last week. So we're not talking to them about South China Sea. We're not talking to them about the coronavirus and what they plan to, how they plan to compensate the world for unleashing this on us. Instead, we send somebody to go talk climate change. The Chinese Communist Party officials are just laughing behind their backs.
John Elliott is right. We have three external problems with China that are pressing. There are threats to Taiwan, as evidenced by invasion of their airspace. Their continued menacing of the Senkaku Islands, which belong to Japan. And until last week, they had amassed an armada of blue hulls. Those are those unofficial, the naval equivalent to little green men at Whitsun Reef, which they have withdrawn, as the Teddy Roosevelt got quotes. Those were all external aggressions. That's in addition to espionage and foreign influence operations. But to go to Beijing, or was he in Shanghai, John? I think he was in Shanghai.
He was Shanghai, exactly.
Right. Yeah. But for John Kerry, first person to go to China, we send the climate czar. It's a total inversion of priority, unless it's their real priority, in which case we're in real trouble.
Exactly. No question about it. It's just so tone deaf. And this isn't the first time that this administration, and we're barely 3 months into the administration, not quite. And they had really an embarrassing exchange with the Chinese, with Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan in Anchorage last month, where they allowed themselves to be lectured for something like 17 minutes by the Chinese officials, Chinese Communist Party officials, about our Black Lives Matter and our racism in this country. And so what you have is there couldn't be more of a contrast between President Trump and how he dealt with the Chinese and how they knew that he meant business. He put sanctions on them. He got the first phase of a trade deal. There would have been a second trade deal had there been a second term. It is just so tone deaf. So not only do we have one story out from Anchorage from last month where we allowed ourselves to be lectured, but now here we go and we say our number one priority, our top official that we're going to send in there, the first one we're going to send in there is going to talk on climate change. It's just really embarrassing.
Coming up, Russia threatens Ukraine while America slumbers.
All of these things start to equate to a climate of weakness, which our adversaries interpret as a climate of opportunity.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Over 100,000 Russian troops have massed on the shared border with Ukraine. Satellite photos reveal the buildup of troops and hardware has been ongoing for weeks. Russia has shrugged off calls to withdraw the troops. Wisconsin Congressman Mike Gallagher is a member of the House Armed Services Committee. He joined me on The Hugh Hewitt Show. I've got a national interest story here. 150,000 Russia now has on the Ukrainian border, and they have mobilized a bomber and fighter fleet there. All signs point to another invasion of Ukraine beyond what Russia has already done. What do you think of the situation?
This is the largest buildup since 2014, I believe. And if the Russians decide to invade, their current posture would only give us hours notice at a max. So questions we need to be asking the administration: how frequently are we communicating with the Ukrainians? How proactive are they being in terms of trying to deter Russia's forthcoming invasion? Does Putin feel this is a Georgia scenario where we have no appetite to intervene? And that is my biggest concern. If you start to add all these things up, whether it's the way The CCP lectured us in Alaska about racial politics in America, added to the continued Chinese buildup and harassment of Taiwan. All of these things start to equate to a climate of weakness, which our adversaries interpret as a climate of opportunity, a period of opportunity for them to make some incredible gains. And so we have to reestablish some credible deterrence ASAP. And perhaps the biggest thing we can do in Ukraine specifically is to get the Javelins in play. As part of the sale of Javelins, Ukraine had to store them in their western regions. We should move them to the front. The Biden administration should be rushing to push through additional sales ASAP because this could quickly get out of hand.
Now, I am assuming an invasion is going to happen, in which case I'm assuming that Russia will win. We ought to forward deploy troops to every NATO country with a border in Russia, and there are, I believe, five of them.
I agree completely, and I fear, I mean, our European allies just don't want another problem, right? Particularly Germany, he referenced, and France. And so I doubt we're going to get any help from our NATO allies on this. I would actually sanction the people close to Putin, which the recent round of sanctions did not do. It was pretty weak if you start to dig into it. You can move a military group of advisors out to the east of Ukraine. You can send a group of ships, not just one, into the Black Sea and keep them there where their spy one radars can monitor the border. You can kill, you know, a variety of targets if need be. Also, I think critically, Russia shouldn't get a summit until they pull their troops back. In other words, they shouldn't be able to use their troops as a chit at a summit that they get some concession in return. So there's a lot of things we can do. But if this spirals, I mean, this is not amateur hour right now. And because we have to deal with this situation at the same time, we're deterring the Chi-Coms from invading Taiwan, which, of course, Admiral Davidson said is likely within the next 6 years. I think it's likely within the next 3 years if we continue on our current course.
Well, it seems to me that we have nothing we can do in Ukraine if Putin decides to go forward other than second level sanctions, meaning forward deployments, disintermediation of assets. But we can deter Taiwan by sending the 7th Fleet to the Straits. I mean, that can happen. They could do that. And the question is, why does Putin fear Biden less than he fears Trump if Trump was allegedly a Soviet agent, a Russian agent?
He doesn't. And this was probably the biggest media lie of the last 4 years. If you actually examine the Trump administration's policy, it was quite tough on Russia. I mean, just ask the Marines who were in eastern Syria that schwacked a bunch of Russian mercenaries. I mean, there was actual tough policy on the ground that the media did not give the administration credit for. We called out Russia for their cyber infiltration of our infrastructure, a variety of things. We repeatedly sanctioned the Russians. And I think Trump himself probably was feared more by Putin than the Biden administration is right now. And I know that there's a lot in the media who would disagree with that statement. This is a very, very dangerous situation. Now, if you ask our good friend Jerry Hendricks what we could do, you know, he would say you could take a page out of the Cold War playbook. We used to practice emergency movements of U.S. troops to Europe during the Cold War. They were called reforgers, return of forces to Europe. You could do something similar along with large economic sanctions. You could surge the army into the Baltics and Poland. You could get the Air Force into Ramstein, the Navy into the Black Sea and the High North. You force Germany to pull out of NS2 at a minimum. You know, you plan to stay in Europe for a year. You also simultaneously surge to Taiwan as well, because China may try something while we're distracted in Europe. I mean, this is the high stakes geopolitics we're playing right now. And I just fear we don't have the national will right now to stand up. And if America is seen to be weak, you can guarantee that every, you know, rogue state is going to be testing our limits, because it's not just Russia and China. It's also Iran. It's North Korea. We still have terrorist groups that want to destroy us in our way of life. The world is a very dangerous place right now, and it requires American strength in order to make it less dangerous. Again, this is not amateur hour. This is very dangerous.
Coming up, a parent stands up to his politically correct school.
This takes courage. And for any other parent listening out there, it's time to make this type of noise at your child's school if this garbage is happening.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Parents whose children attend private schools shell out a great deal of money. And often, those schools are teaching their children a curriculum that is at odds with their own values and convictions. The parents rarely stand up to those educators, though we are hearing stories of secret groups online where parents discuss what they dislike about these schools. But rarely does a parent take those concerns public. Manhattan resident Andrew Gutman did. Salem host Charlie Kirk tells his story.
This father wrote an open letter to Brearley School. Now, if you do not know what Brearley School is, it's an all-girls school in New York City, located on the Upper East Side neighborhood, with approximately 50 to 60 students per grade and about 700 total students in the school. And so this was an open letter by a father who decided in remarkable terms to draw a line in the sand. So I'm going to read this letter. Dear fellow Brearley parents. So remember, he's writing to parents, not teachers. He's writing to parents, not administrators. He's writing to parents of the ruling class. If you are a member of the ruling class, you want to send your daughter to Brearley. Quote, our family recently made the decision not to re-enroll our daughter at Brearley for the 2021-2022 school year. She has been at Brearley for 7 years, beginning in kindergarten. In short, we no longer believe that Brearley's administration and board of trustees have any of our children's best interests at heart. Moreover, we no longer have confidence that our daughter will receive the quality of education necessary to further her development into a critical, thinking, responsible, enlightened, and civic-minded adult. I couldn't have said it any better myself. I write to you as a fellow parent to share our reason for leaving the Brearley community, but also urge you to act before the damage to the school, to its community, and your own child's education is irreparable. It cannot be stated strongly enough that Brearley's obsession with race must stop. America's obsession with race must stop. He continues by saying, it should be abundantly clear to any thinking parent that Brearley has completely lost its way. The administration and the Board of Trustees have displayed a cowardly and appalling lack of leadership by appeasing an anti-intellectual, illiberal mob and then allowing the school to be captured by the same mob. What follows are my own personal views of Brearley's anti-racism initiatives, but these are just a handful of the criticisms that I know other parents have expressed. So let me take a time out here. I don't know this father's political views. I don't. His name is Andrew Gutman. I don't know if he's a liberal. I don't know if he's a conservative. I don't know if he's a Trump supporter. I don't know if he voted for Joe Biden. But I do know that standing up against the institutional mob that is currently educating your child, where all your friends go to school, where all other parents are sending their kids, this takes courage. And for any other parent listening out there, it's time to make this type of noise at your child's school if this garbage is happening. I object to the view that I should be judged by the color of my skin. I cannot tolerate a school that not only judges my daughter by the color of her skin, but encourages and instructs her to prejudice others by theirs. By viewing every element of education, aspect of history, every facet of society through the lens of skin color and race, we are desecrating the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Amen. And utterly violating the movement for which such civil rights leaders believed, fought, and died. I object to the charge of systemic racism in this country and at our school. Systemic racism, properly understood, is segregated schools and separate lunch counters. It is the interning of Japanese and the exterminating of Jews. Systemic racism is unequivocally not a small number of isolated incidents over a period of decades. Ask any girl of any race if they've experienced insult from friends. Have they ever felt slighted by teachers or suffered occasional injustice from a school at which they've spent up to 13 years of their life? And you're bound to hear grievances, some petty, some not. We have not had systemic racism against blacks in this country since the civil rights reforms of the 1960s, a period of more than 50 years. To state otherwise is a flat-out misrepresentation of our country's history and adds no understanding to any today's societal issues. If anything, long-standing and widespread policies such as affirmative action point in precisely the opposite direction. This father is a hero. I know I said that before, but to say that blacks have not experienced systemic racism since the 1960s is standing up to the ruling class, to the virtue signaling mob that is all signaling and no virtue and saying no more. He continues by saying, I object to a definition of systemic racism apparently supported by Brearley, that any educational, professional, or societal outcome where blacks are underrepresented is prima facie evidence of the aforementioned systemic racism or of white supremacy and oppression. Facile and unsupported beliefs such as these are the polar opposite to the intellectual and scientific truth for which Brearley claims to stand. Furthermore, I call BS, he used a more graphic word, on Brearley's oft-stated assertion that the school welcomes and encourages the truly difficult and uncomfortable conversations regarding race and the roots of racial discrepancies. I want you to think and mull over, what if every parent in America did this? What if every parent in America decided to stand up against the people that are teaching your child to hate themselves and hate America? This father from Brearley says, quote, I object to the idea that blacks are unable to succeed in this country without aid from government or from whites. Brearley, by adopting critical race theory, is advocating the abhorrent viewpoint that blacks should forever be regarded as helpless victims that are incapable of success regardless of their skills, talents, or hard work. What Brearley is teaching our children is precisely the true and correct definition of racism. My goodness, good for you. I object to the mandatory anti-racism training for parents, especially when presented by the rent-seeking charlatans of Pollyanna. So the reason this whole thing happened is that at Brearley College in New York, they were mandating that the parents go through anti-racism training. I object to the Brearley advocacy for groups and movements such as Black Lives Matter, a Marxist, anti-family, heterophobic, anti-Asian, anti-Semitic organization that neither speaks out for the majority of the black community in this country, nor in any way, shape, or form represents their best interests. I object, as we have been told time and time again over the past year, that the school's first priority is the safety of our children. For goodness sakes, Brearley is a school, not a hospital. The number one priority of a school has always been and will always be education. Brearley's misguided priorities exemplify both the safety culture and the CYA culture that together have proved so toxic to our society and have so damaged the mental health and resiliency of two generations of children and counting. Andrew Gutman, he's trying to tell the other parents, stand by me and fight with me. And so why is it that this sort of culture is so unbelievably dangerous? What is this soft totalitarianism? It's an attempt to try and not just stop your speech, but stop your thoughts and stop your identity and force you to conform. What he is articulating here is an effective resistance doctrine.
To hear the entire Gutman story, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up, COVID paranoia continues post-vaccine.
You're 300 times more likely to die just by going out and driving 10 miles in any given day than you are to die from, you know, after being fully vaccinated.
The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt when we return. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, the grand jury decides on the Derek Chauvin trial, the trial over the death of George Floyd.
The manslaughter was a slam dunk for the prosecutors.
Albert Mueller looks at the trial in light of our historical moment.
What we are engaged in right now is a great test as to whether we really believe in the American project.
A victory in court over a bill that seeks to protect infants with Down syndrome.
Many think that eugenics ended with the horrors of the Holocaust.
And Ken Starr makes the case for religious liberty.
At every turn, we hear some assault on religious belief and practice.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. America is rounding the corner on the COVID-19 pandemic. 40% of the nation has been vaccinated. The high risk have been largely vaccinated. The rollout has worked. You can live and breathe safely in America once again, or so you thought. Some experts want you to wear a mask or two outdoors, even if you had the virus already, got vaccinated, and are remarkably low risk. I discussed this paranoia with National Journal's Josh Kroshauer. I am a fan of Dr. Fauci, but I can't keep apologizing for him urging people to wear masks after they've been vaccinated. It's nuts, and it's going to destroy what little standing FDA and CDC have, agree or disagree?
Totally agree. And I'm sort of befuddled. And it just is not based in science. I mean, David Shore, I'm sure you've heard of him, Hugh, the Democratic data scientist, he reported that you're 300 times more likely to die just by going out and driving 10 miles in any given day than you are to die from, after being fully vaccinated. So, the degree of just, 100% safetyism that Fauci is demanding is totally at odds with, I think, where most Americans are living their lives publicly.
U.S. health authorities came close to simply warning about a blood clotting risk from Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine, but decided to recommend pausing out of concern doctors would improperly treat the condition, people familiar with the matter said. This is government scientitis, Josh Kroshauer. They have no idea what they did to the Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca rollout in the third world, where the greatest risk to the United States now resides in the production of a variant that can evade vaccines.
You know, public health experts are experts in public health, but aren't experts in public opinion or psychology or other areas that would actually determine whether it's good policy to basically raise a red flag and, indefinitely pause the distribution of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. You're seeing in Europe, by the way, the AstraZeneca vaccine, which has had similar issues of very, very rare cases of blood clotting. The public, in France, I think it's the majority of the public that doesn't want to take the AstraZeneca vaccine. So you're going to probably see similar implications here in the U.S. for Johnson & Johnson, even if they start resuming its use again.
They do not understand that a large part of the public doesn't distinguish between J&J, Pfizer, and Moderna. But a lot of people are kind of drive-by consumers of vaccine news, Josh, and all I heard is paused.
I'm a little more sanguine, Hugh, that there have been some polls in the last few days that show the brunt of the worry is about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines are still viewed just as favorably as before. So I'm not sure if this will raise any larger vaccine hesitancy. What I am worried about is what you talked about, Hugh, about the third world and other countries that need vaccines desperately. The Johnson & Johnson, a one-shot, efficient, effective program, that may be undermined, and getting the world vaccinated makes it much more difficult because of what happened.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producer Charlie Richard, David Poshon, Michael Cook, Alex Perez, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, Harley Eide, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.